This is KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna, listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. I'm Ashlyn O'Hara, and this is the Kenai Conversation. On today's episode of the Kenai Conversation, we're joined by Laurel Downingville, an Alaska historian and author of Aunt Phil's Trunk. Laurel, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for asking me.
All right. So I always like to start Kenai Conversations with a little bit of introduction. I'd love to know more, I guess, first about you, and then also maybe how you got into history. And we'll start with your background.
Sure. I'm a third generation Alaskan, born in Fairbanks, 1951, when we were still a territory. And then my dad in 1959, he was chosen to be Alaska's first commissioner of public works when we became a state. So we moved to Juneau. What a difference from Fairbanks, I can tell you. Well, we were there for about 8 years during the Egan's first administration. And then Governor Hickel was elected. And I must say, my father was a very devout Democrat. And he came home after the election and said, "We will not hang around Alaska while a Republican runs the place." So within 2 weeks, we had sold our home and we were on our way to West Africa.
Oh my gosh. So, you're talking about the difference between Fairbanks and Juneau. I would imagine there's quite a difference between Juneau and West Africa.
There definitely is. Yep. Well, we were in Cameroon for the West Cameroon for the first couple years, and then on to Liberia for a couple years, and then Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, into Indonesia, many other places in between, where my dad helped governments build roads and bridges, like why do you put a shoulder on a road and all that, as he was a civil engineer. I did forget to mention that my mother christened the Taku, the second ferry that was built, because my dad and Governor Egan had foreseen what a value Southeast Alaska would have if they had a marine highway system. So I wanted to mention that and give my dad his credit for that. There were no schools really for me to go to in these remote villages that we were living in Africa. So I got to choose where I wanted to go to high school. Since I'd had 1 year of Spanish in my freshman year at Juneau Douglas High School, I chose Spain and I went to Palma de Mallorca for my last 2 years of high school, studied Chaucer on the beach. It was quite fascinating and fun. And then 1 year of college, my parents really wanted me to go to college. So I went to the American College in Switzerland, in Lausanne, Switzerland, outside of Geneva for 1 year. And then I was 19 and I knew everything, right? So I came back to Alaska to work. Moved to Juneau for a few months and then transferred to Fairbanks, where my birthplace and my brother lived there, and got a job with Fish and Game. And that's where I met my husband. He was a biologist there. Married in 73. And within 6 months, he moved me to King Salmon in Southwest Alaska.
You've just been all over. I mean, that's a...
Well, yeah, we settled in King Salmon, though, for 23 years. So at least I had some stability for 23 years. My husband was a fish and game biologist, and he managed the world's largest red salmon fishery out there when we were living there. And I worked for the phone company. And then after the two children, Kimberly and Ryan, and another daughter, Amy, graduated high school, we retired into Anchorage. And I did not know what we were going to do other than play golf, because that's all my husband wanted to do in retirement. He had this dream. But that's when I discovered I had a strange inheritance. My aunt Phyllis Carlson, who had been the Alaska Reference Librarian when ZJ Lusak Library was downtown in Anchorage, when she passed away, she willed me her entire life's work. She was one of Alaska's leading historians. And she had written many stories in national magazines and newspapers, won awards for them about Alaska's history. And she just loved the history. I was not into history. I do not know why she willed me her work. But once I saw what it was and how much passion she had for it and the work she had put into it, I knew I had to do something with it. But I also knew I needed help, because I wrote great business letters, but I was not a writer in the sense that I could write something that people would want to keep turning pages to keep reading. So, scared to death, I enrolled at the University of Alaska Anchorage, and after 4 years, earned a degree in journalism with a minor in history so that I would have the tools necessary to do this.
Oh wow. So I guess I'm interested because as I told you before we started recording, I did poke around a little bit on your website and I just thought that the story was so interesting. I guess when you're talking about inheriting your aunt's life work, what exactly did you did came into your possession? Was it, I mean, I'm picturing it's Aunt Phil's trunk, right? I'm picturing a trunk full of documents.
Well, yes, it was filled with newspaper clippings of her stories and index cards with notes of those stories with more detail. Index notes of ideas. We had binders full of other clippings and things that she thought would be of interest to future generations. She was known as the Clipper at the library because she was just so adamant about finding things and preserving them for future generations. I inherited books. Old Alaska history books that had notes all over them, all of her diaries. When she would go on trips and she would go investigate things, and she was a prolific writer in that sense, and it was all in cursive, tiny writing in tiny, tiny diaries. So
Oh
there
gosh.
was a lot of stuff.
And was she, I guess, can you tell me a little bit about your aunt in terms of what exactly is contained in all of these, diaries? What era of Alaska was she living in? Did she have a particular focus, things that she was cutting? I guess, tell me a little bit about her.
My Aunt Phyllis, well, her father, my grandfather, was a steamship captain. Excuse me, his father was a steamship captain. In fact, he was captain of the Excelsior and the Portland and the Bertha, the ships that have a lot of history in Alaska. He was hauling people up from Seattle during the Klondike Gold Rush. They're the ones that then climbed the Chilkoot Trail, right? In 1909, he came north and he brought his son Walter with him. Walter being, of course, later my grandfather. Walter and he got into some kind of a brouhaha in the Gulf of Alaska, and my grandfather jumped ship in what became Cordova. He went to work helping to build the Copper River Railroad, and then he became the conductor of the railroad from the day it opened until it closed in 1938. He brought the family north when Phyllis was 5. That would be in 1914. Phyllis grew up in Cordova, went to school in Washington State, and then came back to Alaska and got her first teaching gig in Cooper Landing. And I have that story as we were going to talk about Cooper Landing. But she said she had to stoke the fire of the log schoolhouse at 4 o'clock in the morning to make sure everything was toasty for when the kids showed up.
Oh gosh, I believe that. And I mean, that's very, I feel like an important role, making sure that the schoolhouse is toasty for kids. Well, and so you mentioned, I guess, so we're talking like early 1900s. I can't even picture what Alaska looks like during that time. I guess how good of a job does your aunt do of kind of portraying the scenery? I guess can you tell me a little bit about Alaska at that time through the eyes of your aunt?
Well, not really. She wasn't so much into describing scenery and details, things like that, as you would for a fiction writer. She was nonfiction. So it was the facts, give me the facts, but she told them in a very conversational way, where it's like we're sitting across the table talking to each other, having a cup of coffee. And I, not being a writer, am very blessed that she wrote that way, because had being an author been in my plan for my future, that is the kind of author I would be. So my writing dovetails with hers really easily. Yeah, I think her first teaching gig was like in 1931. She took over from the very first school teacher there. She married the widower of three of her students. And then in 1938, I believe, he moved her to Tyonek, where she taught school there and became friends with Chief Simon Chickalison, I think I pronounced it. I hope okay, didn't butcher it too bad. And he shared many stories of his people and shaman and things. And she was so much loved by the community of Tyonek that in the 1960s they invited her back to their village and gave her a potlatch, which speaks volumes as to how my aunt was received by the people of Alaska. Eventually they moved back to Cordova, and that's what I think really started her on the history trail that she followed the rest of her life. She wanted to know more about the history of Cordova since her father had been part of it. And so she researched Cordova's history and wrote for the Cordova Times. She did serializations of the history and things like that. And eventually then into Anchorage, where my great, or excuse me, my uncle Carl Carlson helped build Fort Richardson, and she then went to work at the library and got even more immersed in the history of Alaska until her death in 1993.
And thinking about, Cooper Landing and Tyonek at the time that she would have lived and worked there, I guess, are there any, stories that stand out to you as you're reading through some of that archival information? I don't know, stands out, I guess, is maybe a little bit vague. Just anything that, is fun or caught your attention or maybe is worth noting of historical significance?
Well, Tyonek was originally a Dena'ina settlement, part of a long-standing network of indigenous villages. They thrived on hunting and fishing and trade at that time. By the late 18th and 19th century, it had become a Russian fur trading post. So it had a lot of Creole people that were the Russians mixing with the natives of Tyonek. And then Russians, of course, brought in the Russian Orthodox Christianity to the village, which I thought was interesting. That far down, I didn't, you don't think about the Russians being in Tyonek. Mostly we think of them on the Aleutian chain, and in Sitka and the like. So by 1920, it only had 58 people living there. So that's a pretty small population because of devastating epidemics and the migration of white people that were bringing things with them. By 1930, when my aunt would have been there, it had rebounded somewhat. It had about 78 residents, so it had boosted its population by 20 people. And of course, those low numbers kind of reflect what was happening in other villages around Alaska at the same time. It was also a traditional stop for mail steamers and traders and prospectors that were crossing the Cook Inlet looking for their supplies because the Alaska Commercial Company at that time had set up a shop. So they would trade fur and fish for foodstuff and goods that the miners and trappers needed. And then occasional prospecting still continued on there about the time she was there, but it wasn't a real mainstay for the community ever. And of course, with no roads or anything like that, the best way, only way really to get into Tyonek would be by boat, which she did.
Did she was she exclusively teaching during this time? Or I guess it sounds like there's a lot of bustling commercial activity happening in that area at that time.
No, it was a bustling community with activity. In fact, my grandfather from Hope, that we have yet to touch on, he built a boat and he would ferry people back and forth between Hope and Tyonek. So
Okay.
yeah, boat was the way.
And of course, I'm thinking, would that be related to Gold Rush at all? Or I guess, like, why were people traveling between Hope and Tyonek?
Yes. In the late 1890s, gold was discovered in Hope and in 6 miles before that Sunrise. Now, Hope is still there. Sunrise, if you go way into the bushes, 6 miles before Hope, you'll maybe once in a while find an old bottle or something to remind you that there was a civilization there. But other than that, it's just forest and overgrowth. But yes, gold, that was actually what brought thousands of miners to that area. At one point, the Hope Sunrise area was the largest population in all of Alaska. It's hard to believe now.
Very
And
hard to believe now.
my great grandfather was one of the first that arrived in the late 1890s. And in fact, he took the most gold of anyone out of Resurrection Creek. He panned 389 ounces of gold in 59 days.
Oh my gosh. Just by
Yeah.
himself?
Yes, he was by himself, and then he sent for his family, which would be my grandfather Bob, my great uncle Charlie, and my great uncle John, and my great grandfather's wife Lavinia, and the Matheson was the last name. And there's a
Okay.
lot about the Mathesons in that museum that you toured through that you alluded to earlier, because they actually were among the first there to create a community. You know, they actually built the first school there, and my grandfather and great uncles were the first students in the
Okay.
school. So that's kind of cool
And
to know.
is that the same? I know they have the historical park. Is that the same schoolhouse that's on? Okay, very nice. I know you can like walk into it and listen, and that's pretty cool.
Yep, and they talk about my grandfather in that little tidbit thingy that they play in the school. So yes, it Hope. Well, my grandfather built a sawmill, and I think he even dabbled a little bit in merchandise with the fortunes they had made with their gold mining company, which they kept going, by the way. But in 1898 or 1897, 1898, the Klondike Gold Rush kind of made everybody leave town on a moment's notice and head for the hills of the Klondike, which kind of left everybody that remained in Hope without much of a livelihood because there were no customers to buy anything. So they kind of lost their fortune, which I always joke is why we still have to work for a living, because there was no gold left over for the ancestors to carry on.
Yeah, I feel like I hear such mixed messages about Hope. It's like, this is an old gold rush town, but as far as like whether there were folks who were like truly building lifetime fortunes of gold, it seems like that maybe was not always the case for everybody who ended up there.
I think it was the dream, not the reality.
So what did
And
your family, I guess, do with the was it enough to sustain a lifestyle for a while, or how, I guess, how much gold was that at the time?
well, after the gold petered out, I mean, that's a lot of gold. There was a lot of gold that came out of Hope. When it petered out because everyone left, my great grandfather went back to Texas. He was originally from Scotland, but he had come to Alaska from Texas where he'd emigrated. Then my grandfather remained along with my great uncle Charlie, and they became trappers in the wintertime and gold miners in the summertime, basically. And I understand they built the very first snow machine in Alaska from various pieces and parts, that they were very innovative. They just did all kinds of stuff. But they were such good trappers. It helped David Greene get his start with David Greene's Furrier on downtown Anchorage, which I thought was quite interesting. And Joe Reddington Jr. told me a story that I guess my grandfather was a really good friend of Joe Sr., Reddington Sr., and he went over there for Thanksgiving, came to Anchorage for Thanksgiving one year, and my grandfather told them, "Yep, I'm a good trapper, but to be a good trapper, you have to catch the critters in the trees that get the critters on the ground." And so he told them how he put traps in the trees to capture the eagles, which at that time there was a $20 or a $50 bounty on eagles, I guess. So he would
That's hard to
capture.
imagine.
Isn't it today? You wouldn't even think of that. But he caught the eagles so that the critters on the ground could scurry about and he could catch them for their fur.
That's
Different
such
life.
a, yeah, that's like such a quintessential Alaska story, like gold and fur trapping and all of that stuff. Did you say what, remind me what had brought them up to Alaska originally in the first place? Was it the steamships?
Oh, yes. Yeah. You could only get here by ship. There were no
Okay.
roads to Alaska and airplanes weren't invented yet, so it was the ships. They were the only means of transportation.
And in going, you mentioned this idea of creating a sense of community and hope, which I think is really interesting just because I feel like that is something that's so tangible in hope even to this day. I guess, do you know why was that a priority for your family, and what were they, were they planning to stay there forever, or what was the idea between, creating the first schoolhouse and doing some of these other things to build community?
That was pretty much the sense, no matter where you went in America at that time. There was no Facebook, no Twitter, no telephones. Some places had railroad. So your life was in a place. You couldn't just hop on into your car and drive somewhere. So you had to create your life in a place. And so all these people that were coming here had left their place. And they were in a brand new location that was totally in the middle of nowhere. And so your only method of communication and building community was to get together and create it yourselves. And that's what they did. And they built what was called social halls, where then you could gather and have dances and potlucks and things that would bring people together, and you would discuss the day's events or the future and what plans you had, and maybe enlist others to help you achieve those. I don't know. But they just, yeah. My mother would tell me, my mom and her identical twin were the first, well, they were among the first twins born in the Anchorage Railroad Hospital in 1920. And they grew up in Hope and went to school in Seward. My mother would tell me about the way they would play, which just blows my mind. They would get on my grandfather's sluice box and slide down it in the water. That would be their slide.
Okay.
And they had pet chickens named Churn Mama and Myrtle that they would dress up in doll clothes, which I find totally fascinating how you would get a chicken to get into an outfit in the first place. But she also tells me this story of remembering as a child, and she must have been a very small child because she was in like one of those push buggies when accidentally her father, a shotgun blast went across the top of the she and her twins' buggy, and my grandmother divorced him shortly thereafter.
Oh my
And
gosh. As far as reasons for divorce goes, I mean, maybe that is up there.
so, but I don't know the real story because I never got to meet my grandfather and ask him the questions, that I wanted to. But on a lighter note, I know she also said when they got from the hospital back to Hope after they were born, the community had built a overhang walkway from the cabin to the outhouse so my grandmother and the girls would not get wet when they had to do their business.
Oh my gosh, that's so sweet. I'm thinking that folks, like currently people who live in dry cabins, would probably appreciate something like that. And so I guess, how you this idea of the Mathesons, right, being so such a prominent part of the history of Hope. I guess how long were they there before sound like they left and went and did some other things. How long were they in Hope?
My great grandfather, the one who found all that gold and started this whole thing, I believe he left in 1900, 1901. But then my grandfather, great uncle Charlie, stayed and they lived in Hope until their deaths. Again, I didn't get to meet them. I've heard stories from people that did know them. One of my favorites of my great uncle was he was an avid gum chewer. And that he would chew gum for a day, take it out, put it on a bedpost, pull off one that he had chewed before, chew that for a day, put it on the bedpost, and he would cycle through these pieces of gum that he had on his bedpost. But I guess you would do that if you don't have a big supply, right? He wasn't part of the throwaway society, let's say that. And he died, gosh, probably in the 1950s from cancer. And then my grandfather died in 1960s. His cabin caught on fire, I believe. There's some mystery surrounding his death that he He was such a good trapper that he always had furs everywhere around his property. And when people went to check because they'd not seen him for several days, they found no sign of any furs. His cabin was burned, and he was dead inside. So I do not know the whole story, but yeah, at least they lived in hope that whole time, all the rest of their lives.
I guess so. How often are you able to go back to Hope? Or I guess how, from your perspective, because I've heard of the Mathesons, but when you go back there, like, do folks have a strong memory of the legacy of your family there, or what's your impression?
Oh yes, every time I go, I go about once a year. I'll be there again the end of this week doing a presentation on a nurse who's been overlooked, in my opinion, during the serum run to Nome in 1925. Yes, I go back about once a year, and I'm always well received, and they bring out all kinds of things to show me of the Mathesons and what they did, and pictures, and tell me who's who, of course, since I didn't get to meet any of them. So yeah, my aunt Hope, my mom's identical twin, came up for my daughter's wedding earlier in the 2000s, and she brought scrapbooks with her that she donated to the museum, and she was received like royalty, of course, being the actual daughter of Bob Matheson. So that was pretty special for her, and I think for the community as well.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the event on Saturday because that, of course, is what brought the two of us together. Can you tell me a little bit about what you're going to be presenting on? Tell me about this nurse.
Her name was Emily Morgan, and we always hear about, the wonderful mushers and the brave dogs that plowed their way through blizzards to get the serum to Nome to stop the epidemic of diphtheria. But very rarely do you hear about anyone else participating in saving lives. And I learned of this nurse that was a public nurse. She had been working in on Alaska, then went up to Nome at the time that this diphtheria outbreak happened. And she was one of the first to actually see the signs of diphtheria in a 7-year-old girl because Emily had had diphtheria herself when she went back to Kansas. So she recognized the dark membranes in the throat and knew right away what it was and raced back to the hospital and told Dr. Welsh what her suspicion was. And then she was charged with being the epidemic nurse. So it was her duty at 30, 40 degrees below zero to get bundled up with her mukluks and fur coat and go to all the residences checking on people and giving shots where needed during that period of time as the actual serum was racing north. So
Oh, wow.
I came across her story and it occurred to me that I just had to highlight her, and especially this being the 100th anniversary year of the diphtheria run. So I've done a nice presentation on her for a couple different organizations, and then was invited to Hope to share it there as well. And that led me, her story, to thinking about women back in the day who have gone unnoticed, but who have done remarkable things, which led me then to actually create a brand new book that just got released 2 months ago, highlighting some of these incredible people like Emily Morgan. I did throw in a few men that I've come across because I didn't want to be called a sexist, but a lot of women are in this new book.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly have never heard of Miss Morgan, before reaching out to you. And that's such an interesting story because I feel like the history, on top of, as you said, it being the 100th anniversary of that being another kind of iconic moment in Alaska history, but also, we just went through a pandemic where the idea of public health nurses and that idea of distributing information and all of that, that doesn't feel too very far removed from, I think, reality right now.
Absolutely. And during that epidemic, all the people were told to stay at home in Nome, which correlates exactly to what happened to us.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was a very contagious disease as well. So, yes, there's a lot of similarities.
You're listening to KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. This is the Kenai Conversation. For those of you just tuning in, we're joined today by Alaska author and historian Laurel Downing Bill to talk about Kenai Peninsula's history in the early 1900s. I guess, when you're researching, Miss Morgan, is that coming from your Aunt Phil's work as well, or is this something that you're researching independently?
It is all on me. Yeah. The way I don't think we got a chance to explain after my graduating from college, if you want to know how Aunt Phil got going. I took an internship in my junior year, 2002, with Alaska Newspapers. And I became their copy editor for their 7 rural papers. Like, it was the Seward Gateway, Arctic Sounder, Bristol Bay Times, Tundra Drums, all Tundra Times, excuse me, little newspapers across this part of Alaska.
Oh my gosh, I'm a Peninsula Clarion alum, so you're really, I'm really vibing with everything that you're saying right now.
Well, that taught me a lot about good reading, good writing and bad writing, I can tell you, being a copy editor. And I told the editor, about my aunts and her research into Alaska, and my goal was to write and publish some of her stories and get it out there to the public. And he suggested that I start writing a little column, and we called it Aunt Phil's Trunk. So every week I would have a little snippet of Alaska history that was maybe 600 words, right? And after the newspaper created its own paper called the Anchorage Chronicle, for a year I was a cub reporter out there covering business stories and all kinds of things. And I won some awards myself, which taught me that maybe I do have a gift now to be able to share stories that people want to read.
So how did you like being a reporter as opposed to maybe being a historian? Not that they're too different, but I guess was the pace at all something you enjoyed?
I loved it. Yeah. Once they told me I could start writing stories, well, I'll tell you this one little snippet, and that'll share with you my enthusiasm, I think, in a different way. I was driving home with my news to share with my husband, and I was passing the Anchorage Police Department. And I whipped my car into their parking lot, went inside, and said, "I'm Laurel Bill. I'm working with the Anchorage Chronicle. Do you guys have any unsolved murders that we can talk about?"
Oh, my gosh.
And that led me to a policeman with the last name of Livingston, and he happened to be working on one of the oldest, well, the oldest case, if you don't count the shooting of Anchorage's sheriff back in the 1900s, that he was working on. It was a woman who had been shot in her car in the parking lot of the Sears Mall in Midtown. And that led me out to her best friend in Big Lake, and I got to interview her. And this detective showed me how they use DNA and how the different things happen. And I had so much fun getting into the nitty gritty and talking to people and figuring this out and actually publishing a story of who we think did it without actually naming a name, because you can't do that if they haven't. The fellow had died already.
Sure.
But that just took me off to following a story on the mortgage industry and how crooked it was back at that time. And I was hiding behind dumpsters to get pictures of some of these bad mortgage people.
Oh my gosh.
I had so much fun. Yes, I had a great time.
I guess I'm kind of surprised. It sounds like you maybe are a more daring reporter than I am. Just walking into a place and kind of declaring that mission, it's interesting to me that was so well received. I feel like I would not have the same level of success if I tried to do that, say, tomorrow.
Well, the stars must have been aligned correctly, because it was wonderful. I did an undercover story on life or meth in Anchorage that was a 4-part series, and it took the 6th place in the William Randolph Hearst Foundation contest nationwide.
Oh, wow.
And brought $500 to the university and $500 to me. So that was pretty cool. That was my first taste of the big money,
Sure. Yeah.
Because you don't make much.
Yes, I'm aware. Well, and so I guess it's interesting that you're talking about like columns and these different types of story formatting, because And Phil's Trunk, those are such like clear, you know, there's volume one, volume two, volume three. I guess when you're sitting down to, I guess, kind of put together such a comprehensive collection of information, I guess where do you start there? How are those organized?
Well, that was the challenge. After the Anchorage Chronicle quit its circulation in December 31st, 2004, I had time to devote to what I really wanted to do, and that was to get Aunt Phil's work out there. So I went into this trunk and I pulled out everything I had of hers that she had written, and I laid it out across my dining room, kitchen, and living room floors in chronological order. And then I just sat there looking at it, trying to decide how I was going to be doing this with pictures. Because one thing that I learned by working at the newspaper was the power of photographs. You can tell a story, and the photographs really bring it to life for the reader. So as I'm looking at that and thinking at it from that angle, I also realized my aunt didn't cover everything in Alaska history that I thought was important. She never wrote about Juneau, for instance. Well, since it's our capital, I thought it was a bit important, and people in Juneau might be miffed if they were not included in Alaska's history. So I researched and then tried to write as my aunt wrote, so the reader would not be jarred with a different style of writing. And as I said, lucky for me, she was a conversational writer, and so that came very easily to me to do as well.
Are there
So,
any, I guess, like nuances in her writing style that, like, any, I guess, like particular phrases or things that you found yourself mimicking or that help you identify stuff that she wrote?
not really. It just had to be not great big words, because I also researched that most Americans are at a sixth grade level for reading. So I didn't want to let anybody not have the ability to enjoy the books. But not really. No, she was mostly, very conversational, the facts, but told in an interesting manner that would keep you wanting to turn the page to see what happens next. And I loved that, because to me, that's the way I want to read. So I thought I had only one book, but when I started researching photographs to go with stories, I started writing my own stories to dovetail her stories to keep the history going chronologically, but covering all the important things that happened in Alaska, but telling them again in an interesting way. My first book, it got to 334 pages with the photographs, and I had only made it just past the Klondike Gold Rush.
Oh gosh. Yeah, that's a small bite at the apple.
That is a small bite. So then I thought, well, okay, I'll finish it off with a second book. That'll be great. Well, unfortunately, the second book only got from 1900 to 1912, because so much happened. I mean, towns like Fairbanks, Valdez, Cordova, and Seward were born. The Iditarod Trail blazed for the first time. The first summiting of Denali. You had Law and Order coming in. Wyatt Earp came to Alaska. I mean, there were so many things that happened. The eruption in Katmai, and covered poor Kodiak in ash, several feet thick. So that one got to 1912. And then a third book, I still had the hope that it would be the last one, but that one made it from 1912 to 1935, because you had the Alaska Railroad and Anchorage born, and airplanes came into existence, and the railroad and all that. So then number four, I didn't give myself any illusion that this would be the last book based on my prior experience. And that one then is World War II and the struggle for statehood, Alaska Native rights. A lot of things are in number four, excuse me. And then the last one truly was going to be my last book. And that got me the first 25 years of statehood, with how we built our government from scratch, the great earthquake, flood in Fairbanks, the pipeline, the Alaska Native rights on their settlement issue of land claims. So that one, and unfortunately, about a dozen serial killers made their way north in that period of time as well. So
I'm
even though I just
sensing a true crime maybe junkie in you.
Well, funnily enough, that you mentioned that, nobody in the family, they've taken it as truth now because they've seen it happen. But I'm down here in my little cubby hole downstairs in my house, and I have a TV set. Anytime I want to get into the writing mood and really get going, I turn on to a true crime. I've got to follow Dateline or 48 Hours or something. It's not that I really listen to it. I think it's the cadence of the announcers. Puts me kind of into a zone, and 13 hours can pass, and I don't even know if I've eaten anything yet. So, it's a good
Sure.
thing for me. True crime's a good thing.
Oh man. Well, and I guess since you have been able to sit down and take such a comprehensive, I guess like piecemeal look at the history of Alaska, this is something I'm just kind of curious about. Is there anything that, when you're putting all of that together, looking back, you realize was tremendously significant and people maybe didn't realize it in the at the time? I feel like, of course, people are maybe familiar with some of the major historical milestones, but Alaska, in terms of being a state, is still such a young state. And I guess I'm wondering if there's anything that you feel like people maybe underestimated the significance of.
Well, one thing comes to mind, a lot of people don't know, Alaska being purchased by the Russians was like a hair's breadth away from not happening. When Russia approached America about buying Alaska, it was in actually 1850s, but then the Crimean War kind of took the attention away from it. But when the Russia came back in the 1867 March and passed that idea out again, and Americans, Congress and Senate and Secretary of State Seward seized onto it, that was just after the Civil War. And during the Civil War, now I want to reemphasize. Secretary of State Seward was about the only guy with the vision that saw the value of Alaska. Well, during the Civil War, toward the end of it, there was a Confederate conspiracy to murder him. At the same time as they were going to assassinate President Lincoln. And the day that Lincoln was assassinated, that night, an assassin assigned to Seward made it into Seward's house. Seward was laying in bed recovering from a carriage accident, and he had a big neck brace around his neck. Well, this assassin made it into his house. He raced up the stairs with a humongous knife, burst into Seward's room, and stabbed him multiple times in the neck before the manservant of Seward came and grabbed him and pulled him off. Seward
Oh
was
my God.
safe because he was wearing this neck brace. But he was deformed because the knife had cut him across from his outside of his lip, kind of down into his neck. So if you see a portrait of him later in life, it's always from a side view, the good side. He didn't want people to see that deformity. But I found a photo of him with a front view showing it that I've got in the first book. But if you stop and think about it, had that assassin been successful, we might still be speaking Russian up here in Alaska. That sale
That's a
may never
crazy story. Wait, so I guess I'm oh man.
So anyway, yeah, it's fascinating to me that nobody thinks about, events that happen elsewhere can make other things happen in Alaska that we had no control over.
Yeah, like the butterfly effect. Huh.
Exactly.
Well, in one other thing, I mean, we've talked a little bit about Seward and Hope, and you had also sent me kind of the list of other Kenai Peninsula communities that there are maybe some interesting stories about, and I'd love to, hear more about the early days of the peninsula if there is, stories that stand out to you.
Oh gosh, there's well, Girdwood, of course, 1925. If we're talking about around the era of the Serum Run and what was going on in some of the other places, because a lot of people know about the early history, but the 1925 era of Girdwood, it was just a small little mining community. As you all know, it's about 40 miles away from Anchorage, and was originally called Glacier City and named for a linen merchant by the name of James Girdwood, who happened to be a friend of my great grandfather's, by the way. But by 1925, that Crow Creek mining operation was just humming along, and the completion of the Alaska Railroad, of course, from Seward to Fairbanks had just happened and had brought a lot of modernization to several of the places along the what we now have as a road system, because there wasn't a road system then. But the year before the Serum Run was the big year for Girdwood. That's when the movie The Chechakos was filmed on location there. It was the first full-length movie that was entirely done in Alaska using the local scenery, the mines, the miners. And so that really brought a sense of excitement and direct contact with the wider world for all the people that happened to be living in Girdwood at the time. And then Seward, of course, 1925, that was the year that the Jesse Lee home moved from Unalaska to Seward, and many of Alaska's native children that had been left orphaned by epidemic diseases, as well as many stayed there because their parents had been sent to sanatoriums to sanatoriums. I always get those two mixed up to recover from tuberculosis, and then one of their residence was a young child, 13 year old, with the name of Benny Benson, that you may have heard of, who won the contest in 1927 for designing our flag. His now famous design graces flags that fly across America, showing the Big Dipper and that North Star shining on their field of blue. So that's their claim to fame during the year that the Serum Run was going. In Cooper Landing, its gold rush legacy, pretty much, they didn't. A lot of miners came in there. It wasn't anything permanent at that time. It was pretty much a tent city, like Anchorage started out. It was named for Joseph Cooper, I learned, who discovered gold in the area in 1884. As the gold mining frenzy lessened, it became home to trappers, guides, and miners. Its claim to fame to me, of course, is that my Aunt Phyllis got to be a school teacher there in the early 30s.
They've still got a really strong school community there around their K-12 school.
Yes, they do. They absolutely do. Another thing that I thought was of interest is that halfway between Seward. Another interesting thing to me that be almost halfway, exactly halfway between Seward and Cooper Landing is where Alaska Nellie Line had her famous roadhouse. And Alaska Nellie is one of the women I am showcasing in my new book, Pioneers of Alaska's Past. She came up later in life, and in 1915, she convinced the Alaska Railroad people to allow her to be the first woman to run a roadhouse for workers and administrators traveling back and forth. And her first one was now called Grand View, that she had a roadhouse up the side of the mountain. And then she moved on to what we later became the halfway stop. It used to take a full 2 days to get from Seward to Fairbanks, and they would have to overnight at almost a halfway port, which a lot of people now might remember as Curry. It became a ski destination and it had, I think, the first swimming pool in Alaska. It was quite the deal. But before that, there was a roadhouse there, and Nellie ran that until just after, I think it was 1924, 25, she was building up her roadhouse halfway between Hope and, excuse me, halfway between Cooper Landing and Seward. And it became quite famous. She was a world-class hunter and a guide. And she was often called Alaska's Davy Crockett. So I think that's kind of cool that in 1925, while the Serum Run was going off, she was busy guiding guys and
She's doing her own thing.
doing her own thing. Kenai, now during the 1920s, commercial salmon canneries were operating along the Kenai River and Cook Inlet. And then guiding and trapping were getting, of course, their real go getting to go really well. Homesteaders were just starting to make inroads. And it's but it's only year-round transportation for Kenai was by boat. Summer brought steamers and small boats from Anchorage, Seward, and elsewhere. And in winter, dog sleds or overland trails were also main routes because there were no highways yet. So while the 1925 Sirim Run to Nome highlighted Alaska's deep isolation and heroism of those mushers, Kenai was not directly involved, but it lived in the same world of limited health care and hazardous travel. Soldotna did not exist. A lot of people cannot believe that. Soldotna was a vast area that in the central western Kenai Peninsula, and it was dominated by thick trees, rivers, and creeks at the time. Unlike the neighboring towns of Kenai or Kasilof, Soldotna just was a future place for homesteaders to come. And that did not happen until after World War II, when the government opened up Alaska land for homesteading. And then you had a lot of the GIs come up and get started there. So I thought that was really interesting. 1947, 48, it really started to take off.
Yeah, I mean, especially like, of course, dip netting's happening right now down here, and driving through Soldotna on, a weekend day in July. It's really hard to believe that this was ever not, a bustling hub for this area.
Yeah, and it's not all that long ago that it was nothing there, except, like I say, hunting and gathering and a fishing spot for the Athabascans. Homer, oh my gosh. Homer, I absolutely love Homer, and I love Homer's history. It was named for Homer Pennock, who was a gold prospector, and he was a very colorful character who arrived on the Kenai in the mid-1890s. He was a gold prospector, a mining company promoter, and is widely described as a con man because he set up a camp on what became the Homer Spit, and he hired a mining crew of about 50 men, and promising that gold would be profitably mined from the beach sands along Cook Inlet. His promise of decent accommodations attracted workers, even away from fish canneries, which was not happy news for the people that ran the canneries. Now, the mining operation was a total failure. The gold claims didn't pan out, and the venture quickly collapsed. But coal is what really got Kenai back on the map and becoming a sustainable community. But one of my favorite stories from the Homer area came from 1896 when the Utopia captain, Johnny O'Brien, sailed into Homer with about 100 passengers. And shortly thereafter, he got really sick and was diagnosed by a doctor who was on board with appendicitis. So they carried the captain off and put him into the home of a Mrs. Banks, who was a Denver newspaper woman. And maybe she was there to cover Homer's grand gold mining adventure. I don't know that part of it. But they laid out the captain on her kitchen table. And the doctor, who had not practiced in many, many years, but was very prone to libations of the alcoholic variety, grabbed a kitchen knife and a pair of scissors. And he took out Captain's appendix and sewed him
Wow.
up with a sewing needle. No one expected the captain to live, but he did. And with the assistance of one of the passengers on the Utopia and a sailor, they got the captain on board. And this wonderful gentleman passenger assisted in nursing the captain back to health. And when the captain gave the orders for the boat to turn around and head to Seattle after he was well enough, the captain learned that the crew had mutinied. They did not want to return to Seattle because they hated the cook's cooking. And so, this good-natured passenger, whose last name was Smith, got a hold of a couple guns, gave one to the captain, one for himself, and pushed the captain out onto the deck. And they persuaded the mutineers to give up their mutiny and head back to Seattle.
Oh my
Well, that
gosh.
passenger's real name, full name, was Jefferson Randolph Smith, who the next year showed up in Skagway as Soapy Smith. So, Soapy Smith was an angel of mercy before he became the king of crime in
Oh.
Skagway.
Oh man. I feel like you hear people say sometimes that like Alaska's really just like a really big small town, and just given the size of the state, it's always impressive to me how dexterously people are able to get around it.
And there's stories everywhere, absolutely everywhere.
Well, I wonder, I mean, we've covered so much, but now we're already like nearing the end of the hour, which is just crazy. But like when you look, I guess, at Alaska as a whole, where do you see the Kenai Peninsula as fitting into maybe that larger story? I guess, you know, sometimes you think of specific areas as contributing, you know, really prominently to one chapter of Alaska history. And I just am wondering where you see the peninsulas and falling in kind of this larger narrative.
Oh my gosh, if you don't think about, the shoulder to shoulder fishing on the Kenai River, I think of the Kenai Peninsula as the serenity spot of Alaska. As you're driving through, it is just so gorgeous and peaceful. I absolutely adore the Kenai Peninsula. I love going down there. The people are so real and fun and independent and good-natured, all the ones I've come across anyway. Maybe I've just been really blessed. But I absolutely love the Kenai Peninsula, and I see a lot of opportunity. There's still down there. There's still vast, wide open places that any person with any gumption can be whatever they want to be on the Kenai Peninsula. I believe that.
You make us sound real great down here. Well, like I said, we're already nearing the end of the hour. I mean, is there anything, I guess I'll throw it to you. Is there anything else that you were hoping to talk about or would like folks to know? I just, like I said, we covered a lot of ground and I did a lot of the question asking.
Well, the only thing that I would like to just promote a little bit, if it's okay, would be the new book, Pioneers from Alaska's Past. We have stories of a wonderful Alaska Native woman from Barrow who survived on an island while her four compatriots that were scientists did not, and she had no survival skills at the time that an incident happened. We have oh gosh, Fanny Quigley. She was an at least middle-aged woman who came to Alaska and carved a life for herself out of the wilds that we now call Denali National Park. One of the stories in there, I mean, to showcase what a woman can do in a man's world, she went hunting and it was getting late. She saw the moose, but she knew she didn't have time to shoot it, go back, and drag it back. She didn't want to shoot it and leave it because she thought bears would get it. So her solution was to shoot it, gut it, climb inside, spend the night in the carcass, and get up in the morning only to learn the carcass was frozen and she had to use her knife to chip her way out of it. These are
Oh.
gutsy, gutsy people, and I tried to do them justice. As I said, we have gentlemen in here too, from Juneau to Eagle to Southeast Alaska to the Klondike Gold Rush era. So I would recommend anybody looking for, it's not really volume six of Aunt Phil's Trunk, but it sort of is. So it's not really volume six of Aunt Phil's Trunk because it doesn't follow chronologically like all my other books, but it is volume six filled with the same energy, entertaining stories, and hundreds of historical photographs that help bring those stories to life. So if you enjoy Alaska history, I encourage folks to go to my website, auntphilstrunk.com, and find Pioneers of Alaska's Past and give it a chance.
Do you know if I guess are there physical copies in bookstores? I'm just thinking, I know River City down here in Soldotna usually has a pretty robust collection of Alaska history books.
Yeah, it just came out, so we don't have it in bookstores yet. It is on Amazon, or they can go to my website, and hopefully, as the summer progresses, it will be getting into the bookshops here in Alaska as well.
And that'll be all for this week's episode of the Kenai Conversation. Thank you so much again to Laurel Downing Bill for joining us. You can hear the Kenai Conversation every week on Wednesdays at 10 a.m. and Saturdays at 5 p.m. here on KDLL. You can also find it on our website at kdll.org. I'm Ashlyn O'Hara. Thanks for listening.